Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Welcome to episode 567 with my guests Anna and Maria Duke. I am Paul Gilmartin. This is the Mental Illness Happy Hour, a place for honesty about all the battles in our heads, from medically diagnosed conditions, past traumas, and sexual dysfunction, to everyday compulsive negative thinking. This show's not meant to be a substitute for professional mental counseling. I am not a therapist. It's not a doctor's office. More like a waiting room that doesn't suck. Website for this show and the social media handles are MentalPod. Happy Thanksgiving, huh? Happy turkey. Are you one of those people that puts the duck inside the turkey? I think what you should do is you should have a turkey with a chicken inside it, and then a duck inside the chicken, and then a mint in the middle. I'm going to copyright that. Let's jump into some fears. This is from the fear survey filled out by a woman who calls herself Broken and Tired. She writes, "I fear that I will never experience healthy romantic love. I fear that I can never trust myself to pick a healthy partner, and therefore I will either continue to choose abusers, adding to my PTSD, or I will avoid people altogether and die wishing I was lovable." Wow. That is deep, and I think so universal. Even people who are in relationships, I think so many people are in loveless relationships, and you just stay in because, you don't want to rock the boat. Maybe you got kids. Maybe you're afraid that you'll never find someone better, or afraid you're going to hurt them. I thank you for that. This is also from the fear survey filled out by Arbitrary Mary. Oh, I am a big fan of your work, Arbitrary Mary. She writes, "I fear that the people I truly care about don't know how important they are to me despite my explicit statements, and that because of my inability to convey my sincere appreciation of our relationship, they will eventually tire of me and unceremoniously ghost me with zero explanation, leaving me to endlessly obsess over every minuscule interaction we ever had in an attempt to learn from my failure as a friend." That is fantastic. I really hope that, first of all, that this isn't true, and it sounds definitely like a catastrophizing part of your brain, but I think it's awesome that you express that you love them. I don't think you can ever go wrong with that. This is from the Ask Paul Anything survey filled out by Lego is okay. And she writes, "Hey, Paul, so after you've screwed up our carefully written surveys and thrown them in the trash can, do you also set it on fire?" No, I don't. I take them to a nuclear plant and I wrap the surveys around the rods that have the expended fissile material, because that more thoroughly makes sure that these are wiped off the face of the earth. And honestly, I love handling rods, any kind of rod, but especially one that's packed with expired uranium. Also, are you working on a book including some surveys? I remember a while back you mentioned it. That is kind of on hold. It's one of the reasons why I think I'm going to crunch that paper a little louder. I took the surveys, being able to read them off of the website because I keep putting off doing this. I want people to be able to, if they choose, to put their email address on the surveys so that if I do include them in a book, I could contact them if I have any questions. But I've not gotten around to that. It's on my to-do list, which is experiencing a beautiful anniversary. This is from the Fear survey filled out by You're a Good Man, Bobby. And she writes, "I fear life. I fear living. I'm terrified of occupying space and being seen. I'm scared that one day I'll disappear and no one will notice. I'm a living ghost." Wow. Wow. I can kind of relate to that one because for a lot of my life, I had a fear that my life will be forgettable. And I when I got into a support group and started doing some work, I saw how that fear was at the core of everything. That I thought my safety in life would depend on me being regarded as exceptional. And then I wondered why I felt so separate and lonely as I was actively trying to distance myself from other people and stand out. Who knew that the place to be is one of many? This is from the Fear survey filled out by One Cool Cat, and she writes, "My biggest fear is being raped. Gas station bathrooms in particular feel unsafe to me, and I try to avoid them as much as possible. I have a recurring fear, almost more like an OCD thought that I've had for years, that when I open the stall in a public restroom, there will be a dead body in there, and God forbid it will still be sitting up straight with its eyes open, so it will look like it's looking at me." Wow. That is so specific. "I'm also afraid of bodies of water, with the exception of bathtubs and swimming pools. I worry I'll either drown or that some creepy creature will pull me down under the water. I've had nightmares about being murdered by giant squid. Not sure where my fear of water comes from." Thank you for those. Yeah, I definitely relate to the, when I'm in a body of water, more the fear that I'm going to step on something that's going to grab me or hurt me. This is from the Fear survey filled out by Chloe. She writes, "I fear that we are going to go into a famine. The government is already controlling our supply chain. I fear that when we do go into famine / desperate times, my child will suffer. I often think of the best way to kill me and my child pain-free, just so that when the famine hits, we don't suffer. This is an absolute last-ditch choice I would make." Wow. Wow. I mean, shit is fucked up out there, but who am I kidding? I have this same fear, but mine is more about a water shortage. We are sponsored this week, as always, by BetterHelp.com, online counseling. If you've never tried online counseling, I am a big fan of not having to leave my house. They have qualified therapists who've been vetted. You can request expertise in a particular area. If they have a counselor that they feel is a good fit for you, they'll match you up with one. And if it's not the right chemistry, you can switch counselors. And I think that's a really important thing, because there is a certain chemistry aspect to counselors. Somebody may be a great counselor, but they and the client, they just don't necessarily click. But they're available in all 50 states. They're licensed in that state, and BetterHelp.com is actually available globally, worldwide. So you can get started in under 48 hours, and I highly recommend it. So if you're interested, go to BetterHelp. That's HELP.com/mental. And make sure you include the slash metal part so that they know you came from this podcast. And then you can get the ball rolling, and you can get 10% off your first month of counseling. This episode is sponsored by When Breath Becomes Air. When Breath Becomes Air by Paul Kalanithi is the exquisitely observed memoir of an idealistic young neurosurgeon attempting to answer the question, what makes a life worth living, as he deals with his own terminal cancer diagnosis. It's a stunning reminder to live while we are alive, a must-read for anyone in medicine, from a doctor-turned-patient. For healthcare workers, expand your view on patient care and the fragile beauty of our mortal lives through Kalanithi's unforgettable words. Some of the questions Kalanithi wrestles with in this book include, what makes life worth living in the face of death? What do you do when the future flattens out into a perpetual present? When the future is no longer a ladder towards your goals in life? What does it mean to have a child, to nurture a new life as another fades away? When Breath Becomes Air is a number one New York Times bestseller, Pulitzer Prize finalist, and named one of the best books of the year by the New York Times Book Review, People, NPR, The Washington Post, Slate, and more. When Breath Becomes Air is available wherever books are sold. Learn more at prh.com/breath.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure, with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
And then finally, this is from the Awfulsome Moment survey. And these are some awfulsome moments filled out by a guy who calls himself hottest tuba player ever. I missed the voting for that, but next time it comes around, I'm definitely going to weigh in. He writes, I've spent most of my 47 years on Earth obsessed with food, more specifically, all the fun foods that doctors tell you to avoid. When I learned to make a grilled cheese sandwich as a kid, it was like I was given the map to Xanadu. I've eaten at McDonald's or Burger King, then made the 12-minute drive to another location just to order the same thing. I've broken into locked rooms that I knew held someone's stash of cookies or chocolate bars. One of my most embarrassing memories is the time my cousin caught me in his kitchen at 3 a.m. trying to open a can of ravioli without a can opener.
I just wanted to get the fuck away from my life.
You know, I couldn't have felt any lower.
Grief, guilt, shame.
Why wasn't I born a girl?
There's a switch that gets flipped in my head.
I'm supposed to be a girl.
I experience being treated like an animal.
How can a just God...
I have a vomit fetish.
...let humans do this to each other?
Help!
I fucking flew over the cuckoo's nest.
My wife's losing it.
I thought it was all about me.
I don't know what to do.
I would have committed suicide if I could have watched my funeral.
A Polaroid I found of my mother, naked in a dentist chair.
And my body doesn't quite...
I think I did 8 days in L.A. County Jail.
...fit how I see myself.
What was it all for? Why are my friends dead?
Everything that I did...
There's a comfort in the scars for me.
...was in service of OCD.
You've already had all the paper cuts. Step away from the paper.
It's really hard to see the picture when you're inside the frame.
You know, it takes a larger view to see your life.
Just actually have somebody listen to you.
Yeah. And I got up and got my tooth and left.
Well,
I am here with Anna and Maria Duke, who are identical twins. You guys also do a podcast called Bipolar Bicoastal?
Oh, nailed it. Yes. Yes. That's what I was going to say. Yeah.
You reached out to me and asked if I'd ever done a show about identical twins and mental illness. I recorded the Sklar Brothers years ago, but there was no real identified mental illness other than being comedians, which is a mental illness in and of itself.
One of the big ones.
codependency, also an issue, you said, with you,
yes,
you guys.
Well, because I was listening to your interview with the woman from Co-Pandemi, and you were asking her about being how codependency showed up with her and her fraternal sister, and she said, not really. And I was like, it definitely did for us. So
yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Especially, yeah.
So where do we begin? You guys were raised, first of all, let me ask, are you comfortable saying how old you are?
Oh, yeah, yes, sure. Yeah,
we just turned 27 in June, so a few months ago.
And where were you raised?
So we were raised in Maryland in a suburb outside of D.C. Called Gaithersburg, if anyone's from Maryland. Yeah, and so we were there up until we went to college, so the whole time.
In the same little neighborhood, like a very... not a gated neighborhood, but like whatever step below that is, like a very like cute
we'd like leave our doors unlocked at night, stuff like that.
Which it does certainly contribute to somebody's sense of safety in the world.
Totally.
It is when I see people that were raised with bars on the windows and robberies all around them, I think that's got to inform the way that you view the world and people, or people who were raised with a parent who was a predator or abusive.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So what was, give me some snapshots from childhood that kind of you feel paints a picture for.
Yeah. So our parents were married up until we were 12, but not a happy marriage. Like, I can't really remember our parents ever kissing or anything like that. Like, I just don't really remember that. And so then they got divorced when we were 12 in middle school, and my dad moved pretty far away to like another suburb of DC, Bethesda.
Did he work in politics?
No, our mom is a lawyer and our dad was a public school teacher.
Okay.
And still is. Yeah. So
They moved to Maryland for our mom's job.
Okay.
So,
go ahead. I cut you off.
Oh, yeah. No problem. So, it wasn't, we were like very, closer, I guess you could say, like codependent growing up. And so we have an older sister as well.
The two of you, you mean?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. And so my mom had like pretty bad anxiety, and our dad had like anger issues. So, So once our parents got divorced, our older sister lived with our mom full time, and we would go back and forth like a really complicated custody schedule. So it was just like really tumultuous from that point forward.
And before that, I mean, there was never stable. Our childhood was never ever stable in the way you think. Like, I've had therapists who think that there must have been like an addict in the family because of how we react and relate to things.
Well, to me, anger is a drug.
Yeah.
Indignation to me is a drug. I'm sure you know people, maybe even a parent, that just they will get something under their craw and they will just go on and on and on about it. And that there is something addictive about being outraged or incensed.
Yeah. And when you're a kid, like managing those emotions, and that's where like the codependency stuff kind of started, I think. It's just seeing like what whenever you have to like read the temperature of the room before you enter it, that's a really bad lesson for
who do I need to be to survive?
It's a really bad lesson for kids to learn, obviously. Yeah. But that was kind of what it was. It's just trying to figure out if it was a good day or a bad day in the house.
And like I remember when we were, I don't remember how old we were, but it must have been late elementary school because our parents were like arguing a lot.
And there was openly.
And there was one year.
You remember what in particular they would argue about? Anything?
It's actually like kind of strange because we were young enough when it happened that no one really explained to us what was going on.
Yeah, no one, we never actually, the way that we found out that they were getting divorced is we We're all on a family vacation without our dad that summer. Which was unusual. But things had gotten so bad, it wasn't surprising with our mom part of the family. And our mom and our older sister went home when they were supposed to, and we stayed with that side of the family for an extra week or so. Mm-hmm. And when we came back, our mom and our grandparents picked us up, and her parents picked us up from the airport and took us to a hotel. And that's how, and but there was never like them sitting us down and being like, you know, like your father and I are getting divorced.
Really?
We still love you guys.
Yeah. No, nothing like that.
Were you guys ever used kind of as pawns in them trying to get back at each other or get leverage?
It's hard to say if it was leverage, but they weren't, in my opinion, they weren't as shy about bad-mouthing each other as they should have been.
Despite us not really knowing why exactly they got divorced. So, like...
Did you ever ask them, or you just kind of... We're like the family where it's just an unwritten rule? You don't bring up certain things?
I mean, it's clear that they hated each other.
So it wasn't like... But we're like WASPs, so like white Anglo-Saxon Protestants. Like, we grew up Episcopalian, so like... feelings weren't like really ever openly discussed. And I think our older sister knew more because she was 3 years older. So I think she knew more than we did. But yeah, I've asked my mom now and she sort of explained more. I think it just like wasn't a great fit for the two of them. And like we're a lot closer to our dad now than we were at the time. But yeah, like we would go out to like, there's one time we went to like an Indian restaurant with my dad and like it just like so many dinners where we just like leave crying. Like,
yeah, so many.
Calling the other parent like manipulative or like that. My dad certainly felt like,
you know what they did actually do in terms of using us as pawns. So our older sister never went back and forth. She opted out of seeing our father. Like she just only sees him like on holidays now. And they're at, again, much closer relationship now than they had before, but she just opted out. So we were the ones going back and forth because in Maryland you can at like the age of, what was she?
16, at least as far as we knew. Yeah.
But what they would do is like when we were in high school, especially my dad moved further away. So like a 25, 30 minute car ride away. And what they would do is blame each other for who had to, like who was responsible for bringing us back and forth. So it was never clear like who was like actually in charge of the parent dropping off or the parent picking up was supposed to be making the trip, but they would tell us if your other parent cared, they would have done this for you, basically.
Somebody should create a TV show where the child of divorce is the judge.
Then
parents who are arguing come before a kid.
Yeah, and there's like some... Sort of
or a panel of kids, you know, a jury of kids.
Totally.
Yeah, we're like, the adults are acting like children and the children are acting like adults. Exactly. Yeah.
So give me some snapshots, some moments. You've given me a couple.
Yeah, so I remember, So I was really focused on getting my license so that we could solve.
This is Maria.
Maria. I was really focused on getting my license so that we could solve the going back and forth thing and like just kind of be able, I could just do it myself. And so when I was 16, I went in for my driver's test and in Maryland at the time, and I think still like...
No, it's actually less hard now.
Okay, so you would have to do like, you know, parallel park, back into a space.
Three-point turn.
Yeah, that was...
Yeah.
Yeah, back into a space. And then you would have to go on the road. And so... the test took like twice as long as it was supposed to, or like than it had like the year before. So they were like really backed up. Anyway, so I went to the DMV, finally got an appointment, went to the DMV and took the test and failed. And I was like so upset because the only appointment I could get next was 3 months later. So I just like cried the whole car ride home. And then I finally got my license like after the summer was over. So like 6 months later. And there was like an earthquake that year, which was like very unusual.
In Maryland?
There's been a few.
Yeah.
And it was actually just one in Baltimore in the past 2 months.
Yeah. So, and it was like the one, if people remember, that like the National Monument, the Washington Monument got like cracked, and like the National Cathedral and stuff. And so, but I had never been in an earthquake before. now that I'm in California, I have. And so the car started shaking. I was like, ah, like as I like pulled in, I was like, ah, shit, like I did something wrong to the car. Right. Like I like put it in like a weird gear and now I'm not going to get my license. And the driver,
while you're taking your test?
It was right as I pulled back to the DMV after that. And I was like, oh, I passed. And then it was like, no, you didn't. I was like, or I like thought in my head, like maybe I didn't. And then he was like, no, you did. Like, you're fine. It was an earthquake. Right. This is really weird. And I was like, oh, okay. And I was like, so excited. Yeah. And then because like learning how to drive was really stressful because neither parent wanted to do it with us. So I probably got like 40 road hours before then, which is like you're supposed to get a lot more. But yeah, that was one. And growing up, I remember Anna and I used to like hide in our closet a lot, like when our parents would fight or like when our dad was angry. And like it's weird, like going back to our childhood closet, like when we were selling or when our dad was selling the house, we had like all this like stuff written on the walls, like about like, I just want things to get better. And I hope that things, so we were just like really attached at the hip. Like we went to a bunch of different summer camps in elementary school and we would like only talk to each other. Yeah. Like
we didn't make friends,
hide during dodgeball, just like really like shy, anxious kids, basically.
Do you remember any conversations when you guys were hiding
Between each other?
Yeah.
I think that we would like mostly sing to each other.
Yeah.
Oh, that's so sweet.
Yeah. That's kind of sweet. Yeah. Yeah.
And I remember too, like in terms of just a story from childhood, just to show how anxious I was. My biggest fears in life were always death, which bummer, that's going to happen. That's right. Going to happen. And mental illness. I never wanted to be like, to not be aware of reality or like out of control in that way, obviously.
The traumatic irony. Yeah.
Both of them, one of them already happened. One of them is definitely going to happen at some point.
Yeah.
But I was so anxious as a kid. We went to an Episcopalian school from when we were 3 to when we were 13. And then we transitioned to a huge public high school. But when I was about 9 or so, my mom took me to like the church, the school pastor, reverend, because I was so afraid of death and I like couldn't stop thinking about it. And she was like, we gotta get something else happening. Right. Like she needs to talk to someone. Yeah. And they just told me like, oh, you know, people have had near-death experiences, like seen the light, and that's heaven or whatever. And I was like, okay, kind of convincing, kind of not, but yeah. I guess I'll just stop talking about it now. Kind of thing.
Yeah.
So whose bipolar presented itself first?
That would be me, Anna. Yeah. So
how old were you?
Sorry?
How old were you when it presented itself?
Oh, yes. I was 22. Well, it's kind of hard with bipolar. So the mania was when I was 22. The depression started in high school, although it wasn't so much diagnosed or labeled that way. I just thought I was a lazy piece of shit.
And a girl.
Yeah. Good self-talk. It's
right on schedule.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. And so like in and out of college, I'd have like these semesters where just I would fail classes or it just nothing got done and was very good at like masking the mood part of it, but not so much like the motivation part of it. Although I did lie a lot about like what I was and wasn't doing in terms of schoolwork, which was also really good. And when I was...
They love that when you're on academic probation. They're like, yes, queen, I about it.
Yeah, I was.
Did you guys go to the same college?
We started... I really wanted to leave. Like, I did not want to be around my family after high school. I felt like so much of our childhood and adolescence had been defined by their dysfunction. When we were in high school, we were the only people that we knew with divorced parents somehow. Like, I don't know what we did.
That's pretty shocking for your generation.
And when we were in our tiny middle school with 18 kids, including us, our best friends' parents were divorcing at the same time. Like,
our
it was
childhood bullies' parents were divorcing. Yeah, no, actually, it was
a different
guy.
Kids. Yeah. Yeah, but there were like 4 kids of divorced parents out of 18. And then we got to a school of 2,000 out of the 150 kids in our, like, magnet program. It was us and one other guy who had divorced parents, and we weren't friends with that guy.
And the one girl.
And the one girl. Yeah. So it was really different, and you know, we like there were so many times where we were like waiting after that. That was another big thing in our childhood, was like waiting around for our dad to pick us up from places. Like when we were in elementary school, the last day of school, we were in I think 4th grade. we were there for like an hour and a half after everyone else left, just reading in some teacher's classroom. And they were like, is your dad coming? Like, do you know? And we're like,
this is before cell phones.
He's supposed to be like, you know, we called the home phone and he said, like, no one picked up, but he's supposed to be kind of thing. And it was like a lot of us trying to just hide how dysfunctional that kind of stuff was. So when things like that happened, it was like, God, like, the teachers know, like, everyone knows that this is happening. Or this one basketball practice, we were there in the dark after everyone left for, again, like an hour waiting for our dad to come. And we called him and he's like, yep, I'm about to leave. And we're like, okay, well, 45 minutes later, like, what's happening? So anyways, or like one time we had to bring like suitcases to school to like do custody stuff, like switch over. Like, it was just, it was always so embarrassing to us that our family was like not functional, and not even like the fun, not like the fun divorce, but like the functional divorce where like the parents talk to each other.
Right.
It was so acrimonious.
Even when Anna was hospitalized for mania, our parents didn't talk to each other.
Yeah.
Like, they just like
overlap.
So talk about the mania. Yeah. You were 22.
Okay. Yes. Going back to that. So in the spring of 2016, when I was 21, our mentor, like our beloved professor and mentor, passed away. I was working on my thesis with him at college, and he had cancer and he got sicker and sicker, and then he passed by the end of that semester. So I had a horrible summer, got into this really bad relationship, and by that fall I was back on campus for my fifth year of college by myself. I knew like one other person, and was just incredibly depressed. And so finally I was like, you know what, maybe we should do something about this. And so I got onto Zoloft,
which is an SSRI inhibitor,
which is important for bipolar, and my psychiatrist prescribed it to me, and then just zero follow-up appointments. So it worked. I became less depressed, and then 2 or 3 months into taking it, I started taking it in like October. By December, January, I was manic. And no one in our family has been diagnosed with bipolar disorder. I was the first.
Yeah.
A real trailblazer. And my mom was like, you don't seem well. I was back home for winter break and I was talking really fast. I was making all of these grandiose plans. I was writing letters to all of my friends at like 3 a.m. in the morning. And my mom like came and was like, what are you doing? And I was like, I just got to finish this. And she was like, I don't think you do have to finish this right now. Like, and Marie and I did, do you know like the book, like The Life-Changing Magic of Tidying Up, like Marie Kondo?
Oh, like I know who she is, and I kind of know the general gist.
Yeah, that was like really big then.
Get rid of anything that doesn't bring you joy.
Yes. Yeah. And so Maria, bless her heart, like we were doing that and we were staying up until like 2 a.m. like,
and were you kind of dragging her along?
We feed off each other. Yeah. So we were both excited about it, but I don't think we would have stayed up as late or done it
as throwing out as much of stuff that we like.
We threw our yearbooks. I mean, just like stuff that I really would like to have now. So dumb. And anyways, so my mom was like, this seems wrong. And she took me back to the psychiatrist, who was like, yeah, you're right. This does seem not great. But she didn't give me anything very fast acting for it. So she gave me, I think, lithium, which is what I'm on now, but it's not like something that will just turn it for you if you're in acute.
And that kind of tamps down
crisis.
The highs.
Yeah,
it's a mood stabilizer.
So right. it's for both depression and mania. Just
I got you.
Leveling it out.
And it's like a long-term thing.
Yeah.
So she arrived that, went back home. I started like safety planning. So I was like really aggressively like, anything in our on that floor of the house that had like chemicals in it, like mouthwash and stuff like that, I just put it all into like the sinks, not even in a trash can, but I just took it out of the cabinets. It's so weird. I know, very unsettling. Yeah. I took it out of like the cabinet. I put like razors and stuff in there, and I was
scissors,
like, keep this away from me.
Lighters.
I took like, I tied up the blinds in my room, like the knots, and I like pushed my bed in front of the window, and I like cleared out my closet.
You were still manic at this point?
Oh, yeah.
Full,
extremely
like,
manic.
Really in
very paranoid. And I was like, I don't want to hurt myself, but I'm afraid if I do decide to hurt myself, like what I'll do, basically. And I just like wanted to sit in my closet and be safe. But I also
wanted to bring myself down basically.
But I also wanted Maria to grab our passports, birth certificates, social security cards, and like get us out of our mom's house and drive us away because I was convinced that she didn't have our best interests at heart.
Another parallel.
I know, because our stepfather had like I had been going into the attic to like find artwork to like decorate my room because I was like, I need to get my room done. Like that's important. And
so weird.
And I found these like two vintage like guns and I was like, Mom, like you knew I was depressed. You know the most You know the most effective way of killing yourself is with a firearm. How dare you keep those in the house? You're choosing him over me. She wasn't. They weren't loaded. I couldn't have done anything that they were hidden. And she maintains that I knew about them beforehand, which she's probably right about. But when you're manic, your memory is so either hyper clear or just nothing. And so I was like, Maria, Mom is choosing her husband over us. Yeah. We got to get out of here. And Maria's like, this is not great.
Yeah. Meanwhile, the whole time I was like, when do we go to the hospital? Like, when does this end? Yeah.
And were you diagnosed at that point with bipolar one or bipolar two, or they didn't know, or it didn't matter?
So
we knew it was bipolar.
We knew it was bipolar, but once I got to the hospital, I think they diagnosed me bipolar one. So at the end of, so Maria ended up calling NAMI, the crisis hotline, who told
National
her,
Alliance of Mental Illness.
Yes.
Great, who, great organization.
Yes. And although this is the thing about crisis hotlines, they're really big into most, a lot of them, like active rescue and stuff like that, like police involvement, which is what ended up happening. She called 911, thought an ambulance would come. Instead, like 4 to 6 cops came. And I was like, sorry, this is like kind of hard to talk about. So I, at that point, was like out of like, I was pissed. I was like, the fact that you guys called them and when they were on their way and I had like taken off all my clothes, like sensory wise, it was like not a thing that I wanted to like have fabric on me and
like naked.
Yes, completely naked.
Yeah.
And my like then boyfriend, I was like, no one come in here. No one come into my room. I'm safe. I like did all those safety footing stuff, but like, I don't want anyone to come in.
Sucked.
Yeah, I was like kicking holes in the wall of the closet and stuff like that, which is, and so he came in.
Primitive way of redecorating.
Yes.
Yeah.
Not Marie Kondo frowns on using your foot to redecorate.
These walls are not bringing me joy. Yes. They gotta go. Yeah. And he came in, tried to restrain me, and I.
Who's he?
My then boyfriend.
Okay.
And I had told him not to come in, and he did. And he had like a bad knee, and like I still feel so guilty about this. And I like intentionally kicked him in it to get him off of me and to, like make him go away. Which he left, and then Maria came in. I didn't hurt her in any way because I would never hurt her. Yeah. And she was like, "You gotta put clothes on. Like the cops are like the cops tried to take me when I was naked. She's like, give us a second. Like please let her put clothes on." So an extraordinary amount, right, of like white privilege that I was not honestly killed at this point because then the cops came in, I was kicking, screaming, they handcuffed me, carried me down the stairs, tried to force me into a squad car because I was still resisting. And that's when I like went limp and they took me in the back of an ambulance with Maria to the hospital.
Yeah.
If I had not been living in like a wealthy neighborhood or if I hadn't had like my white family around me to like, I just like I think a lot about this, like for both of us, like if we're ever like on the street somewhere having like a mental health crisis, like what happens then? Anyways,
and definitely different scenarios if you're a person of color.
Exactly.
Or
Or
even I think if we were
men probably too, right?
Or like larger.
Yeah, like more of a physical, what they perceive as like
exactly.
The cops should perceive with that. I mean, the cops shouldn't be there regardless, right? Why
we don't create some type of governmental service that isn't the cops.
Yeah.
And I think the cops would happily
Oh, happily, my God.
They hate mentally ill people, right?
Well, like, I know that they yeah. feel yeah. that it's probably not a great fit for them and yeah, that there are totally. Other things that they are better
Could
equipped
be
to do.
Because yeah.
I would imagine quite a few of them do have compassion, but
totally.
They are not trained and equipped to deal. There might be some training going on now in some places, but still, yeah. it's the message you're sending to that person who is in crisis is you've done something wrong.
Oh, totally. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And the tools that they have at their disposal are literally just like put them in prison or put them in a hospital. Like they don't have anything else.
Yeah, there are some places, like I know up in somewhere in the Pacific Northwest, there's like a program called CAHOOTS, which is like a mobile crisis unit that can come out. The problem is, though, I think even with those things, for me, since I was violent, they would have called the cops regardless. I don't think yeah. they would have been able. It's not like I was trying to hurt myself. I was trying to hurt others. So it's, yeah, it is such a bad system that we have for dealing with it. I don't even, right, if someone has like a broken knee, you're not going to be like, oh, like, put the cops there to like help right. with that situation. It's like, right. they're not doctors.
It certainly does yeah. complicate it when the person is violent. And I don't yeah. know what the answer is to that. I'm yeah. just thinking from the point of view of the person that is suffering, what is best for them?
And it's not that.
And having, you know, getting shoved yeah. into a squad car doesn't seem like the best reinforcement for that person
yeah.
to right. want to continue to get help.
Right, exactly.
For like a month. Months afterwards, every time I saw a cop, I always have a panic attack. And even still now, it really does. Like, it's like a visceral thing where I'm like, they just like scare me so much because of that.
Yeah.
Do you remember their attitude towards you?
They were
really antagonistic. Yeah. It was
They're
like late
yelling.
At night. They didn't really. I mean, I felt really guilty about the whole thing.
Why?
Well, because I was the one. Okay, so like. Back to, like, Anne and I being, we always would say, like, growing up, like, we're family. Like, we're each other's, like,
family.
The two of
family.
You.
Just the two yeah, of just us. The two of us. And,
like,
yeah, because we were always together, right? Because none of our other family was always in the same, was ever in the same place.
Mm-hmm. After, yeah, 11.
Yeah. And, anyway, so, like, during her whole, like, mental health, I mean, when she was depressed, I was, like, the person who not was managing her care, but was, like, kind of, like, acting as like translator to the rest of our family because they didn't have any experience with it. And then when Anna was manic, I was again like the person who was the person who was like mediating between the rest of our family. So like Anna was like, if Maria earlier in the manic episode, she's like, if Maria
thinks I should go to the hospital.
And
by that point, I was like, I'm not going to the hospital. But earlier, I had said that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and when I called for an ambulance, I thought that they were just gonna send. An ambulance, but they sent the cops and like Black Lives Matter was like going on at that point and stuff too. So I was like pretty anti police force in general, but so I just felt really guilty because I was the one who called it, and then Anna was like traumatized from it, so it felt really, really crappy.
Yeah And the fact that she was the one in the back of the ambulance with me instead of my mom, like my mom was yeah. there, but it's like Maria. Yeah, we just like
really
look out, yeah, like always looked out for each other. So,
and yeah. so then were you hospitalized?
Yeah, apparently it was voluntary. I don't remember signing anything, but apparently for years now I've been like involuntary, and my mom was like listening to an episode and she's like, you know, it was actually voluntary, right? And I was like, I didn't, but I'll switch it now. It was voluntary. I just don't remember signing it. I was put into the hospital. They put me in like a holding room, and for a while I was having like visitors come in and out while they were like sorting through things. It was like the mental illness holding room of a hospital, and the same hostel we were born in, actually, was where I was felt very full circle. And then it stopped because there was a guy, a black man, having like standing in a hallway, like yelling. And apparently that meant the whole operation had to stop. There was like 20 security and hospital staff lining either end of the hallway around him. It's like a huge overreaction to someone who was just yelling and mentally ill, you
and
know.
You believe that him being a person of
yes.
color.
And the reason why I believe this is, so when they did that, I was like, "What the heck is going on?" Like, I want someone to tell me what's going on, but no one will speak to me because like this big thing is happening. So I like threw a chair against the wall, and then they came in and like restrained me and handcuffed me again. And then they explained what was happening. But it wasn't like I threw a chair and like, and then they like 20 security guards came in. It was just one person who was like, you need to stop doing that.
Like, it came with a Cinnabon.
Yeah. They were so accommodating.
Do you feel that being hospitalized helped your care at all? Helped give you clarity? Was it just a totally negative experience? Is it just foggy?
Parts of it are really hyper clear. Parts of it I have just zero memory of. I was there for about a week, and there was a payphone that we could call people from. I was put into the highest security ward because I had been violent when I came in. Highest security ward in one of the, it turns out, we found out later, one of the worst hospitals to like put into in Maryland for mental health. Like people, whenever I tell people what hospital I was in, they're like, oh God. And I'm like, yeah, I know, it was really bad. The DVD player was broken. So instead of watching like fun movies, we watched the news the whole time. And it was like right when Trump
That'll
was
calm
getting,
you down.
Yeah, Trump was being inaugurated and stuff like that. I was, most people in my unit were like either like catatonic or like having psychosis delusions. And I was like just manic, like just very annoying, I think, to hospital staff. I asked a lot of questions. I was clearly someone who hadn't been in and out of the system a bunch of times. So I like had, I was more aware of like what was going on, and I had more questions for them. And like, I remember the first day I got in there, I didn't have my glasses, so I couldn't see the clock. And so I kept asking them
what time it was.
So I was like freaking out, and they got really pissed at me. They got mad at me for like drying my clothes too often. I would do this thing where I would like make my, like warm my clothes up as a little treat for myself in the hospital, like your small comforts. They got mad at me for giving away clothes to people. They just got really frustrated with me, I think. So, and since I was at this high security ward, like, we didn't do, like, arts and crafts. Like, my arts and crafts was just tearing out pages of magazines. And then, this is a scrapbook, kind of. Like, it's just a bunch of magazine pages, like, IKEA catalog. But then I was put into a partial hospitalization program. And that, I think the hospital was very helpful for the diagnosis and getting my, like, meds, like getting me onto medication you had to take it, and I wanted to stop being manic, which is unusual. Most people enjoy their mania. I was terrified
until it's gone and you look at your credit card.
Part of what like landed me in the hospital was I really went to Michael's and spent like $300 on craft supplies, and Maria was like, don't open any of those. like you're not allowed to open those.
I like hid it from her.
Yeah,
like, we're gonna return it. Like,
yeah,
so dumb.
And then the partial hospitalization program was, like, more fun. And I was, again, the only manic person. It's a bunch of depressed people. And then one woman who was a vet who became manic over the course of 2 weeks because the VA did not get her meds to her in time. And that was really depressing to see someone go from, like, fine to not fine because of, like, our system. There's a guy in there who was bankrupt from being manic and was now depressed. I mean, what a horrible... What a horrible cycle to go from like mania and like make all these problems and then go to depressed and like be like terrible at solving problems and like also have like created such huge ones for yourself. I really think there should be a rule about like a law being like if you spend money while mentally like ill, you aren't liable for paying off the debts. But
good luck getting that passed.
Yeah, totally.
I once I didn't recognize it as mania at the time, but I spent $35,000 on domain names.
No.
And this was like 1997, 98, when they were 70 bucks a pop.
Was
like, you know, just till 4 a.m, just one at a time. All these names that I thought were going to be worth so much money and just ridiculous.
Do you remember?
Awful names. Oh, God.
Too embarrassing.
You know, a lot of them had to do with, I don't know, I was somehow focused on... that's when radio was bigger people would sell like jokes to multiple radio stations. It was called a radio show prep.
Oh,
I had a bunch around that, you know, like .net as if something was even, you know, I would get a version of it with the hyphens between
all the words.
This one's really embarrassing, but oldpeoplefucking.com and oldpeoplefucking.net.
What's See, I feel like those ones could have appreciated.
And that's not even
him.
A thing that I enjoy. I was just like, oh, I bet people like this. 400 domain names.
Did that one appreciate in value?
400. What's that?
Did that one appreciate in value?
No. It was awful.
I actually bought a few domain names when I was hypomanic as well.
Did you?
Like, yeah. Well, I was like, I'm going to start a podcast, which I didn't really. But I was like, and I, what was,
I forget what it was too.
Perfectly queer.
Oh, yeah. Something to do with queer. It was our two friends who are not straight. And yeah.
And so you wanted to reserve a domain name for them?
Yeah. Yes. For the podcast that was upcoming. Yeah.
She used air quotes.
Yeah. It never happened. That one never happened.
So, Maria, what was it like inside your skin during all of the struggles that Anna was having?
It was so stressful for me. I felt really guilty, like survivor's guilt, kind of like, why did it happen to her? And
little did you know,
me, oh my god, my time was coming. My time was coming. Yeah. Yeah. And it was like, mania is like a really, like, you get really like aggressive. Most people get really aggressive during it. Yeah. And so
you feel like everybody's holding you back.
Yes.
Like they just don't get it.
Exactly. Yeah. That's a great way to describe it.
And you just, if you could just listen to me for like 30 more seconds, if I could scream at you, you'll understand what I'm saying. Exactly.
The level of frustration between both parties is so high. Trying to deal with somebody who is manic, it's like trying to reason with somebody who's drunk. They are just on a different plane in that moment, and logic does not apply.
No,
totally. And that was the first time that we really hadn't been on the same page in our whole lives. So it was really stressful for me. And the person who I would normally have like relied on was her, and like she was like not able to like obviously support anybody else at that time. Sorry.
A few times with dating, that's the codependency stuff too. Like, if we start dating another person, it's really hard. It was really hard. We're better now to like not feel threatened or replaced or resentful towards the time taken away.
But anyways, so it was really, really uncomfortable for me, and like I missed a lot of work going to the hospital, and I like the night that that Anna was hospitalized, like obviously I went in the ambulance with her and I was there until like 2 a.m. And then the next day I had to be on set for like a shoot, and it was my first shoot. It was for a video for the production company I was working for at the time, and it was my first shoot out of college. So I was like so excited about it. Or one of my first shoots, and then I like got to set and I was just like completely like despondent and miserable and tired, and like I didn't want to explain to anybody like what had happened, and I wasn't telling anybody because like there's like a lot of shame and stigma around bipolar disorder still, and so I hadn't like told anybody what was going on, and I was just like, my sister's in the hospital, like she's going through something, like she's sick or whatever. And so yeah, that was like a really awful day for me. And I remember my producer, she was like trying to distract me. It was like, oh, like how many words can you like type on your phone without looking and stuff like that, and just trying to like cheer me up. But yeah, I just kept like missing work, doing like really poorly at it. And then in like my friendships, that was really stressful too, because almost all of my friends at that point were also friends with Anna, so it was just like really hard to balance. I was going to the hospital like all the time.
And did they know the details of what was going on?
One of them actually, I think, was there when Anna was hospitalized.
Yeah,
so she knew.
I had also called a lot of them when I was before in the hospital. And I was like, you need to come here. Like, you need to fly over if you're not in the state, because I'm going through something. I was also convinced, well, I guess I was technically, and I like became engaged when I was manic to that really bad ex-boyfriend, so I was calling people.
Air quotes engaged.
Yeah, air quotes. I mean, I guess technically, yes, but under like big asterisks, obviously. And I was calling all of them to tell them I was engaged. And then they were like, what is going on with Anna? And Maria was fielding a lot of those questions.
Yeah, and I really hated the guy that she was dating at the time.
Yeah,
valid. So it was really like, I had to deal with him. He wanted to go to the hospital. And like, I was really pissed at him for like even indulging the engagement thing. I was just mad at how everyone was handling it. I thought that everyone was being really kind of self-centered and not taking either taking it way too seriously and like not being kind of like, they were the ones who needed at that point, they were the ones who kind of like needed to be comforted. Yeah, I just felt really responsible for everything, I guess. And there was it was almost harder when Anna got out of the hospital, because then we were living in the same place and I had to go to work, and Anna was like, really, she was like, I can't believe you're going to work. Like, you're choosing it over me. Or like, I would go to a friend's house, and like, understandably, Anna was hurt by that. But I just like didn't have any. There was just like no space for myself at the time. Like, I just
And is that something that you guys feel like you have a better perspective on nowadays about having the need for some independence?
Totally. Yes. I mean, yeah. Anna lives in Baltimore now. I live in Los Angeles, and I think as you get like before, before I went to college, like, every single dream I had, Anna was in it.
Yeah,
like, same. Every single dream. So that's just, like, a level of closeness or just, like, linkedness that I...
Enmeshment, maybe?
That you can't really sustain once you start, like, dating or, like, being your own separate jobs or, like, having... We had, like, almost all... We always took the same classes, so... And, once that changed,
And did either of you ever feel smothered by the other?
Yeah, I moved out. Sorry, it's like so funny to say, of our room. So we had bunk beds at one parent's house, our dad's house, and then our mom's house. We shared a room until we were 15, I think. And then I moved out. And a lot of it, though, was because I was depressed and I wanted, like, I was having all of these emotions and feelings. And I mean, any teenager was dealing with those things, but there's like a darkness to it that when I get in a space like that, I want to be like alone and by myself. And so that was part of it too. Like,
yeah.
So that's why I went to Iowa too. So I didn't want to be like Maria's sister, because in high school, Maria was always, I remember someone was like, Maria is so fun. Anna, you're so reserved.
I like fully don't remember us being different.
I know, but it happened. And so our then best friend made these DVDs for our birthdays our senior year of like all our friends say nice things about us. And the whole time I was just like, I think they all like Maria better. Like, I'm pretty sure Maria was just more fun than I was. That's how I felt, at least. I was so anxious.
I remember with those DVDs, it was just my shitty ex like the whole time.
Yeah, but like people would no, but it wasn't.
Okay, that's just how I remember it.
Yeah, and anyways, regardless, I wanted to do my own thing, and I really did until I like my first semester of college. I really did like thrive socially. It was just academically I wasn't doing anything. I just really like was struggling with procrastinating and things like that. And so eventually we went to the same college. The first three semesters of college I went to school in Iowa, and then I transferred to a community college for my semester. What's it called, like when you take a semester?
Oh, your like leave of absence.
My leave of absence. I still did go to class. My mom, bless her heart, it was very much so like, yeah, you can take a leave of absence, but you're going to be going to classes during it. I was like, okay. So at community college, and then I transferred to Maria's school, which I had gotten into originally. But
so, Maria, when did your bipolar begin to present itself? How long after Anna's?
A year and some change. Yeah. So,
and how did it present itself?
Oh my God. Yeah. Just everything so long. So. A year, the spring of 2017, when I was 23.
2018.
Mm-hmm. 2018, when we were 23. It was a hypomanic episode, we think, because it was very long. And so...
And there's no psychosis.
And so... The first symptoms I had was like speeding up is like how they talk about it. So like my energy level was just like super high. I wasn't sleeping more than like 6 hours a night, which is really unusual for me. And
speaking quicker,
even quicker.
Sorry,
yeah.
To listeners.
Speaking. Well, actually, it's funny because the weekend before I really started like ramping up, I had gone to a frisbee tournament we had, and I had spent like the whole weekend kind of like yelling from the sidelines and stuff like that. So I actually didn't have a voice for like a few days when I was first ramping up. So yeah, I was on set for a horror film, and so I was shooting nights, and So I was like, I would come to work at like 12 p.m. and leave at like 1 a.m. And so I would like write on a notepad whenever I had to like communicate to anybody. I was like, oh, but like still like very excited and like kind of charming and like just doing a lot of stuff, like just being really like out there. Like I like got into a lot of like friendly like arguments with people and like made a lot of friends on set. But yeah, and then my other like first symptom I would say was like hypersexuality, which is like.
Thank you for mentioning that, because yeah. A lot of people are too ashamed to talk about it, and I've gotten so many. I've experienced it before, and people who have written to me or filled out surveys, they talk about it. And again, like buying things, you can't see it at the time.
And there's really lasting consequences to it. Yeah. And it's really hard to talk about. Like you're saying, like that was one of the things I was like the very most ashamed of after I became depressed. But anyways, so I was
enduring it because you hid it from like our family too.
Did you hide it from Anna?
She minimized it.
Yeah.
Because I got really nervous about it.
She doesn't like hearing about like sexual stuff.
Well, I didn't.
Yeah. She's more open to it.
It was more so like traveling to people's houses that she didn't know. And I'm just very cautious about stuff like that in general. And honestly, that was really hard for Maria. I didn't want me judging her.
Yeah.
And there was like some. Yeah. Yeah.
But anyway, so.
Are you comfortable sharing what it looked like?
Totally.
Okay.
Yeah. So I had been dating the same guy for 5.5 years at that point, and we had started talking about maybe moving to Los Angeles. I was living in D.C. at the time, and it hadn't been going well. I think we both kind of realized that it was like our time was kind of coming up. And during that week that I started speeding up, I was like, I think I'm queer. I think I'm polyamorous. I was like excited about it. I didn't think that anything like wrong was going on. And so I broke up with him.
You mean medically, not morally?
Medically. And even morally, I was like, this is just who I am. Like, I guess I've just been hiding it for myself. And I'm still queer. So that stopped.
You're saying that you are still queer today?
Yeah.
Okay. Like, I didn't know if you meant that you were saying that to yourself back then or today.
Yeah,
okay.
Great clarification. And so I came out to him. We broke up, like, in one day after, like, 5.5 years together. And I, like, hooked up with a guy that I met on set. And so that was like the beginning of it. And by hooked up, I mean, like I had like sex with him. And then it was just like a string of like 20, maybe like one night stands / like several night stands with like strangers from like Tinder and Bumble.
Guys
named Matt from Virginia was my mostly. Like my pocket. Yeah. Despite being queer.
Do you have your own zip code named after you?
Yeah. Totally. Yeah. Arlington, Virginia. They all know me.
Worst state too.
Virginia. But yeah, so anyways, so I bought a car for $14,000, which isn't that much, but I like had never had a car before. So that was like the spending came in and I was able to like get to strangers' houses a lot easier with that. So yeah, and it was a lot of one night stands, a lot of unprotected sex, because not that I wanted that, but like the guys just like wouldn't use condoms or like.
It didn't matter to you.
It did matter to me, but I couldn't convince them to do it. And it was before the Me Too, or no, it was like in the middle of the Me Too movement as well. And honestly, like there's a lot of sexual trauma around it even at the time, because I would ask them to use condoms and they just like wouldn't. And I had never had sex with anybody else before, because I just had been dating the same guy the whole time, so I wasn't used to advocating for myself in those situations, and I didn't really feel like I could leave if they didn't do it. So yeah, it was just like I got
Was the feeling like you couldn't leave, was it emotionally you felt like they would be upset, or were you physically worried about your safety? That
it was more like emotionally and like people pleasing, I think. Okay. And like feeling like I was just like, I felt like I was like very charismatic and like persuasive, and it was like really frustrating to me that I couldn't convince these guys to do something that I felt like was in both of ours best interest. Mm-hmm. So anyways, I got like a few like STIs and stuff like that, and like I had to deal with it for like way long after the summer was even over. So I was manic from March 2018 to July 2018, so like hypomanic. That was like a really long time. And those were like my main symptoms.
During the hypersexuality, yeah, were there flashes or moments where you were saying, this is not the real me, something is going wrong? Or was it just a, you know,
yeah,
this is the new me, this is awesome?
That's how it felt. But also because Anna had bipolar disorder and we're twins and it's a very genetic disease, like, yeah, as I'm sure you know, mm-hmm, I knew that there was a possibility that I might also be bipolar despite never having been depressed before. And so when it first all started happening, like the first week or so, I like told my mom that I thought, oh,
Gracie, come here. Come here.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, I was like, I think I should keep an eye on this. Like, I don't think that I'm like becoming manic because it didn't look at all like Anna's.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't like so rapid and it wasn't like immediately dangerous to myself, mm-hmm, in the same way. And so, yeah, and my mom was like really concerned and she like called like my like health insurer at the time and stuff like that.
No, I called them.
You called them. Okay, got, yeah, it. Yeah.
We tried to get her hospitalized. That was just our frame of dealing with it. Mm-hmm. That's what we did with me. And so we're like, well, she's not in the hospital, that something's wrong. But you can only get someone hospitalized as an adult if they're a danger to themselves or others.
And I wasn't.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I went to see a psychiatrist and he gave me Seroquel, but a really low dosage. And I took it because he was like, oh, it's for sleep. And so which is what I actually still take now for it's an antipsychotic and sleep aid. And I took it and I like almost passed out in the shower. So I was like,
fuck this.
This isn't for me. Fuck this. I'm just going to like keep, yeah, going. I'm not hurting anybody. And I don't think I'm bipolar. And then when I came down, that's when I was like, oh, shit, like I probably am bipolar. That's what was going on this whole summer. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so what was your plan of action then once you had some clarity around that?
Yeah. So the way that I came down was I was on a shoot for The Voice, actually, in Virginia again. And I got really bad strep throat to the point where like my throat was closing up. And I hadn't treated it because I was like manic and like, whatever, like still having fun. I'm still got energy, yeah, like no big deal. And so I was on the set and I like couldn't even like lift like Pelican cases. Like I couldn't do anything that I was like supposed to be doing on set. And like I couldn't really like drive cars because I was just, like so sick. I couldn't really like eat. Not that I was eating like a ton at the time anyways, because of the mania. And so I like finally got home. I got the other production assistant to like drive us home and return the car. And I like, my mom was like, you need to go to urgent care, like for the strep throat. And I think she was like, in the back of her mind was like, oh, finally, like we'll get her like hospitalized or whatever. And so I did. And they're like, well, you need to go into the hospital for observation because your airways are so closed. And so I was in the hospital for a few days and that's when I came down. And, cause I like couldn't do anything and, mm-hmm, I was just like sitting there. And maybe it's just like my time anyways, because I'd been going on for so long. And I was like talking to Anna and I was like, oh, my like body image is just like really off. And I feel like I look like scrawny and that's not how I felt at all. Like when I was manic, I was like, oh, I'm hot shit. Which was being reinforced by like all these guys in Virginia named Matt. And And so anyways, so Anna was like, oh, it sounds like maybe you might be depressed, kiddo. And I was like, a light bulb went off and I was like, oh my God, if I'm depressed now, I was probably, yeah, manic all summer, huh? And, yeah, she's like, maybe. And, yeah, so then when I was depressed, I really wanted to get help because it feels awful. So that's when I went to go see a psychiatrist and he got me on a mood stabilizer and Seroquel, but it still took a few months to get the right dosage and come, yeah, out of it. Yeah.
And when do you both feel like you hit a level of manageability that you were able to kind of come together and, mm-hmm, and have clarity on it and feel optimism about, yeah, moving forward, yeah, if at all?
Yeah, it was when Maria was depressed, probably, because, yeah, when she was manic, which totally valid, this is just how mania works, she did not want to hear that something was wrong. So I was like, you know, I think it might be bipolar. And she said, that's impossible it made me feel, I don't remember if she said this or just me hearing it this, but it made me feel like my life was like her worst case scenario. Mm. Like having bipolar disorder was the worst thing that could happen.
Right.
Because I associate it so strongly with hospitalization.
Right. Yeah, and it was, I mean, it is tough sometimes. I mean, it's not, she's not wrong. It would be nice to not, you know, always have that in the back of your mind. Like, when's the next episode going to be? But
has anybody ever... had somebody say to them, I think you're manic right now, and they just kind of
like,
go,
like, oh my God.
You know what? I think you're right.
I'm going to make an appointment with a psychiatrist and just like get it figured out.
You exactly. made an excellent point.
Yeah. Oh my God. Wait, when you say it that way, yeah, it really does.
I'm going to slow down and really mull that over.
Yeah. I'm going to just fast forward to the depressive episode, I think. Like, let's go for it. Yeah.
Let's stop feeling this way for sure. Yeah. And I think that's too, like, when it was like, I think after both of us had gone through the experience of being the bipolar, like being the manic one or being the depressed one, and then also being the one watching it, we had a lot more empathy for how hard it was on the other side. Because when I was manic, I was like, this is easy for you. It's hard for me.
Oh,
I'm the
God.
One going through something.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
And even for like a year afterwards, I was like, listen, if it was like everyone in our family gets off scot-free, and I'm the one stuck with this, like, not in the time thinking horrible diagnosis, but this, you know, this chronic illness that's mm-hmm. does affect your life. And there was a lot of feeling with the rest of our family, not so much with Maria, of being like, well, Anna's mental health, we all now have a right to hear about
it,
keep
an eye on it,
to check mm-hmm. up on it, to like,
and this is after like a whole childhood of like basically feeling like no one gave a shit how we felt. So it felt like super hypocritical to me as well, personally.
Yeah. And then, but then once I was the one who was having like watching Maria go through mania, so helpless, so powerless. And honestly, it felt bad if I had to like set boundaries around time with her, even though she was going through such a hard time, because we would get in these awful fights or she would just do things that were really scary to me, or
for instance,
well, like leaving to go see someone or hearing about those things, I guess, like hearing about the guys that she was seeing, or to her, it was all of it was very funny, and none of it was funny to me, you know, and it was just weird.
Remember like a specific night or something like that?
Yeah, well, there was this one night. This wasn't scary, but it was just so not Maria. We were going out with like one of my work friends and some of our friends from college. Sorry, she saw her specific night. And like Maria was just like flirting.
Maria shaking her head.
I know.
And embarrassing.
So embarrassing.
She's cringing.
I know, I'm sorry. It was like Maria was like flirting with like my work friend. And I was like, it's like my best friend from work. And I'm at the job. And like one of my main goals was to like make friends at the job. So I had some like friends in D.C. And to be fair, my friend was also flirting with Maria.
Was this your housewarming party?
No, that's a different night. That was really early. I didn't notice that. It was weird what happened. She was just flirting with all the guys at my housewarming party. And I thought, oh, she's just single. And it turned the next day, our friend who was there when I was manic and hospitalized was like, do you think Maria might be manic? And I was like, oh, you're probably right.
Oh, no.
And that's when I called our health insurance and was like, maybe she can be hospitalized. And they're like, no, she can't. Anyway, so it was that night she was flirting and like dancing with us, and I was like, hey, like, do you mind like just like this, like the one person, like maybe like could you not try to hook up with my friend from work? And Maria just like, that is so like unfair, like no. And I was like, left the dance floor and just like sat by myself, and I was like, this is like not so fun. Like this is not exactly how I wanted things to be going. And I felt again like the twin who was like so uptight, and Maria was so fun and charismatic. Mm-hmm. And so it really made me like just affect how I looked at myself. And I was like, it's just not healthy for me to really be around Maria as much as I want to be for her during this time, because I start like looking down on myself, but also really trying to control her behavior. And number one, you can't when someone's manic. Like, I don't even know what you could do.
Or like, in general.
In general, yes. You can't, yes. Exactly, that's
you
what I say. Like, in general,
people.
You cannot control, and that was the biggest lesson, and like, was you cannot control a grown person's behavior, period. Like, it just is not possible. If it was, Maria would have been in the hospital, she would have got her bipolar diagnosis, and it would have lasted a week instead of 4 months, but that's not what happened. And so, when she was depressed, it was much easier for me to be there for her because we weren't getting into fights, and she honestly remembers it.
And frankly, the person talks less when they're depressed.
We should just watch TV together again. Right. It was so nice. It was like, I missed it. And Maria remembers that I was like such a savior, and like so nice, and went out my way. It wasn't. I was there for you the normal amount of time, but like we just were hanging out again, and it was so easy for me because I was so happy to have my sister back again, like listening and talking. And I was really sad that she was so sad, but that was, I think, when we kind of reconvened. And you know, we've doing the podcast as well, we've had a lot of these like tough conversations about things that happened when both of us were manic that we've started to like forgive each other more for, I think.
Yeah.
Like the hospital stuff, I had a lot of resentment about the fact that I went to the hospital and Maria got just like live her life for 4 months. But now it's like, okay, well, even if there was a better case scenario, which I don't know that there is, that's not what happened. It right. did happen. We're both safe and like healthy now, and everyone was doing the best they could at the time with the information that they had. Yeah. So, yeah.
Is there anything else you guys would like to share before we wrap up?
Let's see.
Your podcast is called Bipolar Bicoastal.
Yeah, yes. And so it's a mixture of just the two of us doing episodes or having guests on and interviewing them.
We had Ellen Forney on, who is a bipolar graphic novelist and is
our personal hero.
Yeah.
And we're like doing, we're going to have a bunch of guests on with ADD and ADHD for ADHD or ADD Awareness Month in October. So yeah, it's really fun. And they're like hour long, a little bit shorter episodes.
A little bit shorter now. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, thank you guys so much for coming on and opening up about all this stuff and, you know, covering some new territory for us.
No, yeah. Thank you for having us on. Yeah. This is such an honor. Yeah.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. So go check out their stuff. Enjoyed talking to them.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey. Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Let's dive into some surveys. This is from the Love Survey, filled out by ladies and gentlemen, prepare to be disenlightened. And they write, I love that I'm about to, he writes, I'm a, well, I guess it's a he. I love that I'm about to go to prison, but I'm doing everything I can to be a better person while I'm waiting. I don't know why I assumed it was a guy. I love that I know my pup will be so excited to see me in 2 years or so from now, and I'm doing my best to be okay with leaving him. That's probably more a fear than a love, but I'm trying. Honestly, Paul, I'm trying to love. I do a good job some days, but today's not the day. Other than my dog, I don't love many things. I'm scared. Thank you for sharing that. And, I've never been locked up. Actually, I got locked up for 3 hours for underage drinking when I was 19, but that hardly compares. Why am I comparing everything to my life? Because it's all about me. No, I guess I want to, I'm always in the podcast looking for ways to let people know that they're not alone and they're not freaks. This is from The Babysitter, filled out by a woman who calls herself lesbian, and then in parentheses, not a pedo. She identifies as gay. She's in her 20s. And she writes, when I first started babysitting at 12 years old, I would have intrusive thoughts about raping the baby boys I would watch. Now I am 21 and watch a 4-year-old girl who I see a lot of myself in. I have the desire to become too close to her, but it's not sexual. But it reminds me of emotional incest. It's like I'm doing one of those inner child meditations where you hug your younger self, but I pretend she is me. She is so worried about being good for me and will clean up her baby brother's toys as a present to me and begs me to let her help me clean. I live vicariously through telling her she is good, that I'm proud, that she is seen, helpful, and that I appreciate her. I give her opportunities to feel like she's helping me out, and then I thank her profusely so that she feels like she made a difference, and I hope it helps her self-esteem. I babysit her overnight sometimes, and I want so badly for her to sleep in my bed and for us to cuddle, in parentheses, not sexual, but like how I would sleep with my grandma when visiting. I fantasize that her parents don't come home and that I just become her mom and it's just us two. I feel guilty because she has a super adorable baby brother and I only care about her to this extent. When I was 18, I babysat a newborn and would let him suck on my finger or my cheek. He was a newborn, so he probably thought it was his mom's nipple or something. It would give me tingles in my body like how sex does. I think it positively affected me because I just non-judgmentally and curiously thought and thought and thought about this until intrusive thoughts about baby boys I would watch never came back. I feel relieved that I am no longer feeling intrusive thoughts and that I know that it was not an actual desire. I feel fondness and longing for that little girl all the time. She is just so sweet, and I feel like I wouldn't damage her as much as her mom would. I feel grateful that I know that this is all somewhat deluded and that I am still connected to reality. I am aware that this whole thing is about me and my childhood. You are such a self-aware person. I'm always worried that I am damaging the little girl by being too emotionally invested. I have no idea if how I think I am helping is helping, because I'm doing it because my opinion is that our mothers accidentally damaged us in the same way, which sounds egotistical, therefore it probably is damaging her. I'm afraid that when I eventually leave this job and she will feel abandoned by me. I feel innocent, but I know this is about my trauma or something. Thank you for sharing all of that. You seem like, as I said, a very, very self-aware person. And I think a great example of how intellectually and emotionally we can have two different things going on at the same time. This is from the Shame and Secret survey filled out by a guy who calls himself Chewy's Beard. He identifies as straight. He's in his 30s. He was raised in a slightly dysfunctional environment. He's never been sexually abused. He's been emotionally abused. He writes, "My ex-wife made me feel as if I was the worst father and husband on the planet, to the point that even after being apart for 4 years now, I still question my ability to be an effective father for my children and feel as if I am failing them all the time. She also had an affair that ended our marriage, and for a long time I blamed myself. Isn't that fucking silly? Any positive experiences? I do have positive memories. However, I've blocked out most of it as a coping mechanism because it just makes the guilt I have for myself magnified. Darkest thoughts. I have a crippling fear of mortality. When I think about it, I can't move. I can't breathe. The weirdest part of it is that I am a person of faith, albeit non-traditional, and do honestly believe that our consciousness continues on. But damn it, if I don't get thrown into a spiral of despair when I consider the notion that this is all I am. Darkest secrets. I am a slob, and I don't know why. I tend to hoard garbage. My car will fill up with empty cans, etc., to the point where there is no room for passengers. I don't know why I am this way. I cannot explain it, and I feel like the worst person because of it. Why the fuck is it so hard for me to pick up a goddamn can and throw it away? has become an issue with my partner to the point that she has told me to get help or we won't survive. This has been an issue all of my life, and I wish I knew why I have this. I truly cannot explain it. For whatever reason, I don't think about it. I see a mess and keep moving on to something else that I'm focused on. My brain does not register it. I also believe that I am undiagnosed on the autism spectrum and worry that because of my age, it's too late to make an accurate diagnosis. Yes, I know it's up to a professional to do so. I cannot handle overstimulation. I am anxious any time I'm in a busy space, not even crowded, just busy. We have four children, and when they're playing, it's hard for me not to become overwhelmed with everything going on around me. It's as if the door for information going into my brain is stuck open, and I hate it every day. I've been diagnosed as ADHD twice, once as a child and again when I was 26. I'm about to turn 40. I'm afraid of medications because I often feel less than who I am. Not that meds are bad, they just scare me. Sexual fantasy is most powerful to you. I am kind of weird here. I view sex as sacred between two souls. So honestly, I don't really have any beyond just being with my partner. You are a monster. You are a monster. Wanting intimacy and closeness. Wanting sex to be something sacred. What, if anything, would you like to say to someone you haven't been able to? I want to tell my partner that I'm so sorry for being so scattered-brained and a mess, that I love her and our family to the point where it makes me sad sometimes that I let them down. What, if anything, do you wish for? Self-acceptance and the ability to be aware of a mess and get rid of it. Have you shared these things with others? Parts, yes, but afraid to go deeper because of judgment and embarrassment. How do you feel after writing these things down? I'm not sure. A touch freeing mixed with shame. I don't like this part of me. Anything you'd like to share with someone who shares your thoughts or experiences? Do something before it's too late. Don't let someone else dictate how you feel about yourself. You are important to this world. And if someone doesn't want to see that, they can fuck off. Amen, brother. A fucking men. And I'm sorry that you're feeling stuck. You sound like a really nice guy that is, like you said, just feeling overwhelmed. And you don't have to be alone with that. You do not have to be alone with that. This is an email that I got from Shilpa, and they write, "My attempts to reach your number always resulted in an unavailable message?" This is something that I was not going to reveal publicly, but I'm on the run. I've got the law nipping at my heels because this is going to sound silly, but I mailed a letter one time and I reused an envelope. And I know that that's a federal crime. And while nobody is coming after me, I want to get a jump on them. So I've got a series of safe houses around the country. I don't know why, but they're all next door to each other, which seems like an oversight. And so I move from house to house. And a lot of times those messages, they fall between the cracks. And I apologize that I didn't get back to you, but I hope for whatever reason you're trying to get a hold of me, that we can get our project off the ground and you and I can really become the friends that we're supposed to be. Maybe you'll move into one of my safe houses with me. This is from the psych ward experiences filled out by Sad Girl. And she's in her 20s, and she was hospitalized for being manic and suicidal. And she writes, "I walked into the emergency room at 12 a.m. after everyone I had called told me I needed help. I thought I was already dying, so I thought I would speed up the process. I was so heavily medicated at the hospital with heaven knows what there were that what that heaven knows what that there were days I had to be wheeled from my bed to the bathroom. I was there over Thanksgiving. I didn't realize it was Thanksgiving until they served us a puny Thanksgiving meal for lunch and someone said, "Happy Thanksgiving." I was devastated. All my hard work to get out of the hospital beforehand was practically wasted because, quote, no doctors were available near Thanksgiving. The visit helped only to scare me away from being suicidal ever again. I was so elated when I got out that I told a stranger who lived near me, "Hey, I just got out of a mental hospital." I still feel embarrassed about that and luckily haven't seen the neighbors since. Thank you for sharing that. Oh my God, so many naturally awfulsome moments in psych ward experiences with people. And then this is from the Back in Time survey. And these are various people's responses to the question, pick a positive moment in your day, use all your senses. What did you see, feel, smell, and think? And this person writes, I felt connection when the three-year-old I nanny rested her head on my leg when I was reading to her before bed. It also comforts my inner child because I wanted physical touch and attention and to not feel like I had to beg for attention growing up. That is really sweet. Someone else writes, this morning watching trashy reality TV in bed, and my tiny black cat came up to snuggle. She curled up with her little paws on my arm and laid her head down to rest as I gave her her favorite rubs right between her eyes. I felt grateful for a moment to have that connection with another being, to just exist together in bed on a Saturday morning. Someone else writes, it smelled like this summer as I walked by Joshua Peck in the park today. I thought to myself, hey, an actual real-life human I know that listens to the Mental Illness Happy Hour. What a sweet man he is. And if you haven't listened to the episode where he was a guest, give it a listen. We had a great conversation. And then someone else writes, I walk around a lake most mornings, looking at the mist on the lake and feeling the crisp air that's finally arrived. It finally feels like the weather is changing after months of humid and sweaty walks. I felt relief at the weather change and reminded that things keep changing and can hopefully change for me too. I love that. I love that. I mentioned a couple of weeks ago that I wrote a little piece of music for guitar that I wanted to share with you guys, and so I thought I'd combine it with a list I wrote for things that I am thankful for. So I'm going to roll that, and before that, I just want to say this is a tough time of year between Thanksgiving and the holidays and New Year's, and I'll be taking December off and running best of episodes. So I'll see you in January. But in the meantime, be nice to yourself. You're uniquely positioned to be your own best friend. So why would you talk to yourself like your worst enemy, said the pot to the kettle. Anyway, here are things that I am thankful for. And never forget that you are not alone. And thanks for listening. I am thankful that I have the use of my arms and legs, that I have a place to live, and I don't have to worry about where my next meal is coming from. I'm thankful for the feeling of love and emotional safety I have in my relationship with my girlfriend. I'm thankful for Gracie's excitement about life. Gracie's my dog. I'm thankful for my friends. I'm grateful for the laughter at my Sunday night poker game with my comedian friends who I've known for decades. I'm grateful for the depth, emotion, and details that you guys, the listeners, pour into the surveys and how they help me and other people with their issues. I'm grateful for the guests who trust me and open their souls and reveal things that are hard to talk about. I'm thankful for the generosity of the donors who help keep the podcast going. I am thankful for Indian food. Not only does it taste amazing, but it reminds me how many spices nature makes and how abundant the world is. I'm thankful for the way Gracie runs to the room after I give her a treat. And it reminds me that this little stray dog that used to try to tunnel her way out of the backyard now feels that this is her home. I'm thankful for the ability to speak my truth and to be vulnerable and to let people love me as I am rather than trying to be someone I'm not in the hopes that I'll be accepted, because I think that the authentic me is enough. I'm thankful that I found support groups that are helping me grow in the right direction rather than feeling stuck and hopeless. And I'm really thankful for discovering the power of asking for help or admitting that I don't have an answer.